Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of What's Next. I'm associate producer Michael Loss. Today, the What's Next team travels to Providence Farm Collective for a tour of their site. Later in the show, we'll also check in with Duncan Kirkwood about his upcoming student leadership conference. But first, over the summer, BTPM reporter Alex Simone sat down with Dr. Jennifer Roberts of the University of Maryland. Roberts, a Buffalo native, launched her inaugural Bet in Flow program, which introduces East Side teens to Buffalo's green spaces. She also discusses her upcoming book about Buffalo's history and future, emphasizing the city's rich heritage and ongoing environmental justice efforts.
So yeah, Jennifer, being from the area, right, I guess first of all, what's it like to be from Buffalo and take sort of your hometown with you into your professional life as a professor?
It feels good. Like, it's funny because initially, like, I would say going way back decades, like when I was a teen or about to start college, I was like, I couldn't run away from Buffalo fast enough because I just thought there was so much to explore and so many things. And I've had, you know, opportunity to do that, lived in different cities, traveled internationally. And so I've been able to do that. But, you know, coming back to Buffalo always was home, you know, and I think in my later years, I became to appreciate it more. And it just was like a natural progression for it to kind of be infused into my work as a professor, whether it's, you know, a case study for a class that I'm teaching or the topic of the book I'm writing or even just research. So it's kind of a nice kind of full circle to be able to do this work in an area that really is just like, you know, it's pretty much my DNA. So it's very natural.
Speaking of coming full circle and passing it on to a new generation, you had the inaugural event of Bet in Flow, your program introducing teens from Buffalo to some of the really important green spaces, right? Especially teens from the east side of Buffalo to these integral spaces from Buffalo's history and teaching them about that significance. Could you maybe go a little more into how that went, especially having this be the first year and really getting that off the ground?
Yeah. So Bet in Flow, it stands for Buffalo East Side Teens in Frederick Law Olmsted Parks. And I probably could say some of the inspiration of this, well, there's multiple levels of inspiration, but one was really last October, I think it was, I came back to Buffalo for an Olmsted pop-up. So the general national level of Olmsted Network, they would have these pop-ups where they would go to different cities in the United States and showcase the works of Frederick Law Olmsted. And so when the one in Buffalo occurred, I was like, oh, I definitely have to go to this one. And it was like a 3-day, 2-night type of event where we stayed at the Richardson Olmsted Complex. Now, mind you, you know, I'm like 51 years old. And at that point, I had no idea that this complex had even existed. Like, I always knew of the history in terms of Buffalo having an asylum, But I had no idea where it was in the city. I had no idea the history in terms of the architectural history. But I certainly didn't know that the complex, the landscape of it, was as massive as it was, and that it was like landscaped by Frederick Law Olmsted. And so the fact that we were able to stay there, because it's been restored into this beautiful hotel. I mean, it's just exquisite. But it still has like the bones of an asylum, which is really, really wonderful. I mean, some people think it's kind of like, I wouldn't say scary, but, you know, if you play with it in your mind too much, you probably can get a little freaked out. But the beauty of it, to me, overshadows that. And in any case, I was like a kid, you know, like on a school field trip for those 3 days of the pop-up. I was like, oh, my goodness, what is this? And so after stewing on that for a while, I was like, wouldn't it be great, like, if I did this for kids who grew up on the East Side? You know, I grew up on the East Side for a good portion of my life. But even I went to high school on the West Side, and I still didn't know this existed. So I was like, I wonder if there's a lot of kids who are like me, who just don't know this even exists. And so that's when I was like, you know what, it'd be great to kind of mimic that Buffalo Olmsted pop-up for teens. And so I applied for a grant through a fellowship program that I was a part of formerly, and I was able to get the grant money. And a colleague of mine, Dr. Greg Brotman, who flew out from Seattle with his PhD student, Connor Lashes, and then my PhD student, Sasha Chavez, she came. She's my PhD student at University of Maryland. So the four of us were able to like launch this program. We were initially supposed to have 10 teens, but we ended up with 6. And actually that ended up being like a nice size. You were able to have like the intimacy of, you know, just working almost like one-on-one with the kids. And so they came, and we actually kind of mimicked the pop-up that we had in October. So we did tours of various Olmsted parks and parkways, and the students were able to actually rate them according to, you know, its beauty, how it made them feel, if they had ever been there. And for some of them, many of the participants had never been to some of these areas on the West Side. And then, you know, we had a really nice dinner at the Terrace in Delaware Park, and they absolutely loved that. And then what was nice is we had East Side stewards come and give like a presentation on environmental justice during the dinner time. And then the last day, we did a restoration at Riverside Park, which, you know, involves some weeding and picking up trash. And so it was like kind of a nice kind of aspect of, you know, this kind of multi-site green space experience where they immerse and it fostered outdoor diversity, inclusivity. And it kind of like, you know, advanced this kind of whole idea of planetary stewardship with the restoration. And so when we were ending it, you know, a lot of the teens were like, wow, we wish it could have been a week, you know, you should make it much longer. We had so much fun. You know, they were saying they didn't want to leave. And so, you know, all in all, I think it wasn't a success. You know, it was a lot of work. You know, we had been preparing for this probably since the beginning of the year, actually maybe even before that. So it was a lot of work. Luckily, we were able to partner with Buffalo Olmsted Parks Conservancy. So thank goodness they were the ones who actually gave a lot of the tours. So that was great. And the accommodations, you know, the hotel was able to work with us in terms of, you know, helping us, you know, keep ourselves within budget. So it was a collaborative effort. But all in all, I do think it was a success.
And even as you're talking about that, right, I am kind of thinking about possibilities for the future, right? So like you mentioned wanting to keep it small, but also the students very much being interested in doing a longer, I guess, mm-hmm. retreat, right, would be a good word for it.
Right.
Do you think it's feasible even to maybe expand the scope of it insofar as like other locations, right? As we have talked about previously, Olmsted wasn't limited to just Buffalo, right? He even did stuff in Niagara Falls, correct?
Right.
And do you think there's maybe any possibility to that of, you know, showing them, hey, this architect who is very significant for Buffalo actually has a greater significance within the area as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely always possibilities for that, you know, particularly since, you know, like we didn't even go to all of the parks within the Buffalo Parks system. So there's definitely, you know, opportunities for expanding it. And like you said, Niagara Falls, all the work that he did there. And then, you know, even being able to virtually go to parks in other states. It's funny because I have a colleague who does a lot of work with virtual reality. So even being able to mimic a visit to, say, Stanford University, that campus, which Olmsted was, you know, instrumental in designing that as well. So there's many different possibilities for being able to expose these teens to all of the work that Olmsted did. And, you know, I just think, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of what we can do. It's just a matter of, you know, being able to get funding and being able to get, you know, a collective support, because it can only really launch successfully if, you know, with partnerships and just being able to have like a full kind of collaboration, because it's just so many moving parts to being able to do this. And particularly when you have a, you know, a minor population, you just want to make sure you have all your ducks in a row. So, you know, it's definitely possible, but definitely with a lot of partnership.
And how about in terms of some of your other projects, right? You've done quite a bit as well with the Kensington Expressway project, right? And I guess green space inequity, right? Would that be a good word to use here?
Yeah, okay, exactly. Yeah.
And what the future plans for Highway 33 through Buffalo should be. And having been involved in that process for so long, could you kind of give your perspective on where that all stands, you know, again, from the involvement you've had and where maybe you see it going in the future?
Yeah, definitely. Well, for one, I kind of came in when Eastside Parkway Coalition kind of just already probably in gear for at least, well, maybe a year, because I kind of like latched on during my sabbatical last year. And it's really been so wonderful to see what this grassroots organization, and when I say grassroots, literally grassroots, starting from like Candace Moppins at the Delavan Grider Community Center and Brad Wales, just the two of them starting a meeting, and then it just growing into a full-on organization with legal representation. And so I am just inspired by the work that Eastside Parkway Coalition has done, because that is a true testament of grassroots organization and work from the community. And they were instrumental, really, in bringing forward a lawsuit, which put a stay on the Kensington Expressway project. So that Supreme Court ruled, you know, that DOT, they didn't do a thorough environmental review. They didn't do an environmental impact statement. And so until they do that, the project can't begin. So that stay is until however long it takes them to do that. And so that right there was a big win. I mean, you imagine just like this small grassroots organization, and, you know, and some other, you know, plaintiffs came on, but really just like the fire behind it was this Eastside Parkway Coalition. And they were able to pretty much have this lawsuit against, you know, DOT, like the whole state. And so I feel like that is so inspiring, you know, in terms of when you're talking about environmental justice and being able to just do the work, do the activism to achieve some level of justice. And then recently, Eastside Parkway Coalition also filed an appeal against DOT. Again, in terms of this second suit, it alleges that there was a violation of the public trust doctrine and the New York State Green Amendment. So back when the original Humboldt Parkway was turned into the Kensington Expressway back, you know, in the late 50s and 60s, they are saying that on its own was a violation. And so that is why they were able to file this appeal. And it's going to be several months until we hear the results of that. But that was a success, again, you know, being able to file that, you know, and Alan Bolzer, you know, who is the attorney leading a lot of these legal efforts, you know, it's amazing how the work that he's been able to do. And so in addition to the legal part, there's still the constant of informing people of what exactly T has proposed. Because for a while, there was a lot of confusion, and there may still be some confusion about, well, it's going to connect MLK Park to Delaware Park, or, well, is there going to be a part two, or, well, it's going to do this. So it was really about informing people of what exactly the plan was and what it wasn't. And so that still is a continuing process that Eastside Parkway Coalition does. They're continuing their efforts, you know, with having events, large, small. So in June, you know, we had kind of a session at the Meriwether Library where I was presenting along with Frank Kowski, who's written the book, The Best Planned City in the World. Basically, I say he's the end all be all of everything Olmsted in terms of Buffalo. But he's also writing a book on his partner, his unsung partner, Calvert Vaux, who I think it's going to be a phenomenal book because we always say Olmsted, Olmsted, Olmsted. But so much of his work was partnered with Calvert. But anyway, I digress. So we did a nice kind of like hour long presentation at the Meriwether, which I also think was a very well received. There was a nice full audience. And the first like 30 minutes, Frank talked about Olmsted and how he came about to Buffalo, just the origination of the whole park system. And then the last half, I talked about the benefits of nature and why nature is like something that is not a nice to have, it's something that we need to have, you know, and how when you don't have it, you have all of these, you know, kind of like adverse health impacts. And so then I also highlighted the fact that, you know, there's significant nature inequities when you look at the west side versus the east side. And so I think there's so much going on, and I just love how it just keeps rolling. And even though I'm in Baltimore, you know, I'm still able to be involved. And I just really give shout outs to the whole that whole Eastside Parkway team for just their efforts. They're just continuing efforts. They just have so much fortitude. So I'm excited to see what can happen. Like I said, the appeal, it's going to take, you know, a few months for us to hear what happens with that. But it's still great that, you know, we're still moving in the right direction, in my opinion.
And when you see all of this stuff going on, right, the fact that you are also now working toward the completion of your first book, right, and does all of these discussions and working together with the Eastside Parkway Coalition, does that kind of get you maybe more motivated to, okay, I gotta sit down, I gotta pump out another few chapters for my book and that kind of thing?
Yeah, definitely. It actually, I think I get motivated, you know, in several ways. The fact that I'm learning so much about this history of our city that I just didn't know, just the very, very, very beginning. And then all of the missteps that were done along the way. So it's a wonderful kind of project, this book, in the sense that I would say, like, it's kind of divided into almost like more or less four large sections. And like the first 2 to 3 sections are really the history of what happened. But like that last section, which I think is exciting and has yet to be written, is what will happen in the future. And so it's kind of nice to be like, oh my goodness, I don't even know what I'm going to write for that last section because we are in the making of history. Like, we don't know what's going to happen. And so there's something exciting about that in being able to say, okay, well, you know what, this time 3 months from now, or this time 4, 5, 6 months from now, you know, when I'm towards the end of writing that fourth section, who knows what can happen? Unlike, you know, like the first part where like, the history's done. It's just a matter of me uncovering it and reading about it. So there's something kind of exciting about that. And I'm just very motivated to even write the book. To me, it's kind of like a love letter to my hometown. And it will highlight and amplify Buffalo for all its beauty and just all of the rich history that this city had, and really kind of elevate it to people, to knowing like, this city was quite powerful. This city was prominent. Like, it was really doing some wonderful things. And so I love the fact that I have an opportunity to really showcase Buffalo and tell people, yeah, this city is more than football, more than wings, more than, you know, snowstorms. It is this wonderful city that has this really beautiful, rich history. And it's really also making a wonderful history in the making right now.
That was Alex Simone with Dr. Jennifer Roberts. Since the recording of that interview, there has been an update on the lawsuit mentioned in the conversation. Here's Alex Simone with more.
New York Department of Transportation has announced the project is on hold after a judge ruled in favor of East Side residents against the Kensington Expressway project. Governor Kathy Hochul says it's a major roadblock preventing progress.
It feels too frequent here in Western New York that people with a different opinion decide to go to court and to basically stop what I thought was going to be significant progress for the community. So that's what happened. So we stepped back and said, well, the court said no because these advocates have asked for it, basically shut down the project until it's more in line with what they want.
She says the ruling extends the process a few years as the state will have to reset and do further environmental assessment.
Thank you, Alex. Next, the What's Next team takes a trip to Providence Farm Collective. For more, let's go to Jay Moran.
Recently, What's Next executive producer Charles Gilbert and I spent a sunny Friday morning at Providence Farm Collective in Orchard Park. The intent was to tour their new building, which is a combination of a farm store, washing station, office space, storage areas, and more. And while we spoke with Executive Director Kristen Heltman-Wise and Deputy Executive Director Hamadi Ali, we also had a chance meeting with a visitor, Grace Karambizi. She's a lead organizer of the Buffalo Immigrant Leadership Team, and she talked about their recent effort to teach some of the region's newest residents on the workings of government in America.
We just finished a civic engagement, actually, training where we talked more about basically understanding the local government, who is who, who does what in the city, and we also did the budget, what is the budget, the city budget compared to the Erie County budget, as well as the state budget and how that affects us in Buffalo and where the money is going. Because we're preparing also to have a new mayor, what are the things that the immigrant and refugees, or those most of us who have become, former immigrant and refugee who are U.S. citizens, who participate, who vote, what are the things that we want to see in Buffalo where it is more inclusive and where our voice is heard? So, yeah, things like that.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting when you were saying that. I couldn't have wondered how, you're explaining this to whomever your constituency might be, is interested in finding out more, they come through you.
Yes.
How confused? I mean, can you describe how long it maybe takes to kind of really try to help people understand what the way this works in Buffalo and Erie County?
So it is already confusing.
It's confusing, I know. I've been doing it for 62 years.
Most of the people who came, I wonder if I pass my anniversary. Actually, I've been here for 21 years.
Okay.
So most of the people who really are interested have been here about 10 on average. You want to understand the government, but we also have couple newer person who came, who still we all still figuring out what the city, the county, and what is that, who does what, so it does take the time. Even after a while you figure out don't know this, and actually one of the things that prompted it was someone who has been in the U.S. For 25 years, I was I only vote for the presidential election. And we're but locally, that's where we have much more impact. What other thing can we do locally to make sure that our voice are heard? So it is arranged, but it does take a long, long time, basically.
Right.
But I think, I believe that civic engagement is very important and understanding. So we are going to do those series and repetitively too, some information. It takes just time to get it. We have worked a lot with the school system, and it's understanding how decentralized the U.S. education system is and who does what, and what is the role even of the board, once you go outside of the district, if you are in another district, it takes time. And some people is not until maybe they have moved or going into another in the suburbs, they realize, oh, my child cannot be going to the Buffalo school. So it does really take a long time. On average, sometimes you just learn by error.
Are you originally from, Grace?
That's another question. I was born in Rwanda. I was born in Rwanda, But I think like I spent so much time outside of the U.S. because I left when I was 8, and being a refugee in Congo, DRC, back when it was Zaire. I'd stayed there for 2 years, and then we were brought back in 1996 to Rwanda. I stayed in Rwanda for 1 year, and then my family also have to flee. And then been in Ivory Coast for 7 years before. So Cote d'Ivoire, they don't like to be the country to be translated in English. Been in Cote d'Ivoire for about 7 years before we were settled in Buffalo, New York, in 2004, September 14th. So.
You both came.
Yeah.
Hamadi came in the fall of 2004.
Yeah.
Literally month apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, came in August of 2024, August 11th.
Yeah.
2004.
That's
yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
And so how about what brought you out to Providence Farm?
Well, Providence Farm. Personally, I came because that's like my mental health. Like I like to be here. Like, I signed up to volunteer, so I came to. I was like, okay, this is a perfect occasion. I haven't been able to be here the entire summer. I can come and spend some time outside of the city, but like also supporting PFC. So I think I know a lot of the farmers and buy produce from them, attend the market often as much as possible. It's just, I think it's a place of peace. So the first, that's why I came here, but it's also supporting. I'm always like, I talk about PFC, like I feel like Pacific Christian should hire me to do marketing. No, seriously, like in every space, I'm like, you should see a PFC, you should come and check it out. And even people like, because a lot of our community members also have like garden in the back of their house, and I'm like, you should come and check it out. There's land that people who are doing this, like, and also really knowing that you eating organic food, like something that is grown out of like the land. Many of us haven't really experienced that. Actually, I did not experience that until I started like knowing more about like PFC, because you just go to the market and that's, you know, the supermarket, and you grab what you need. But I think there is something of being here and seeing the plants grow, or like, and seeing actually also the face of the other farmers, like how they feel. Like I was speaking with a couple of them because I've known them for a couple years. Mm-hmm. Just like the joy, like, you know, to be able to be in the field picking up picking like their crops, things that they have done themselves, I think is just is amazing. When I think of PFC, I always think about mental health. It's access to food, definitely, but like even a notch, you know, father, is that we talk a lot about mental health for immigrants and refugees, and that's something that is familiar to them. It's something that is a skill that they bring in and they are able to enhance it. So they have more joy. They have joy here.
Grace Karambizi of the Buffalo Immigrant Leadership Team, who we met during our recent visit at the Providence Farm Collective. This is What's Next. I'm Jay Moran, along with executive producer Charles Gilbert. Our tour with PFC's Hamadi Ali and Kristen Heltman-Wise followed some turbulent months for the organization. Earlier this year, their grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture was canceled. The reason, as it was explained in a somewhat baffling letter, a PFC program did not coincide with Trump administration priorities regarding DEI initiatives. Through a lawsuit, that funding has been restored, though there is a sense of resignation. They may be forced to eventually return the dollars to the federal government.
With all the negatives we have experienced, but this isn't, seems like it's been a very successful season. Actually, I I and the markets manager were going on a field walk yesterday, and I was explaining to him. I was like, hey, I've been here for 5 years. I was the markets manager and doing field walks, and around this time of the year, I've been struggling to find produce to put in our CSA and donate. But this year, not as much. We have a lot in the fields.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, I mean, so, it's been a great growing summer, hasn't it?
It has. It has been dry, but also it's been great.
Yeah.
So I don't know how the two reconcile, but it's been a very
somehow
good...
Somehow it's all worked out together.
Yes, it did.
We'll take
yes.
it. Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, lead the way. So this is the new place here.
This is the new place, and that is the old place.
I've been
and
in the old place.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I was heading that way, actually.
Yeah, and I probably both of you, probably all three of you need a mark. That used to be our old wash and pack station, and I will show you the new one in
okay.
here, so you can see the difference.
All right, very yes. good. Very good.
Wow.
Wow.
This is our farm store.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, we're super excited. I don't know. There's the lights finally. So how often we open?
2 days a week now. Monday from 3 to 7 for our CSA members and also for the public to come and shop. And then Thursday from 11 to 4. Those are the 2 days that we are open, but we are in the works of thinking, adding more days to that.
Are you selling just produce from here?
Just from Providence Farm Collective.
Okay.
As of yesterday, we got a refrigerator and a freezer, and we have some meats from other farms. Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
they
wow.
were in there, but I had to take them out because I didn't know that was on and how to turn it on. So I took the meat in a different freezer. So
yeah,
it wouldn't,
So we're starting to stock meat. Eggs, right?
Milk.
And other things that people have asked for. We're also working on, so over the winter, shelving's going to be built and different sorts of displays and stuff. So we're really excited. Last year, we started a small hive, so we have bees. We sell PFC bees.
Wow.
Or bees, honey.
How much honey are you making?
Not a ton, but it's at least a couple hundred jars a year.
Wow.
It's been so far, and they sell. This is all that's left right
sure.
now.
Mm-hmm.
So so that's been really great. We love this space in that we've been able to thank our supporters for the capital campaign in a way that represents us. So we worked with Stitch Buffalo Artisans. To create their representation of agriculture, and they made these beautiful quilt squares, and you'll see donors' names on them. We worked with Brendan Bannon a couple years ago on a cyanotype project. We actually have some cyanotypes that are 20 by 15 feet that have families on them with the vegetables they grow.
Okay.
But this is one that one of our farmers wrote a poem on, and so we have that. We have a local Orchard Park farmer who in March gifted that hoe. It's over 100 years old. It was his great-grandfather's. He used it on the farm not far from here, and he had that plaque made. And when he gave it to Hamadi, he said, I just want to say thank you for continuing the legacy of agriculture in Orchard Park.
Wow.
So we hope when people come here, they just feel very welcomed and at home and the warmth of this community.
Do you feel that it's expanding, that embracing of what you're doing out here?
I think it is, and I think as people learn more and more about us and the fact that we're the only incubator farm program west of Ithaca, and that program, because of the grant termination, is at risk, people are starting to think about, how do we feed ourselves as a region if we're not creating a new generation of farmers, if we're not protecting farmland, if we're letting developers just come in and build houses in space that, there's prime agricultural soils, that puts us all at risk. And so I think as people learn, everybody enters at a different level, but they get it. They're thinking about it now. And I think that that's been really good.
Is it the wrong time and wrong venue to talk about the grant and where that stands at a legal standpoint?
So, no, it's not wrong. Okay. Legally, it's still in the pipeline. So the lawsuit's still progressing through the federal courts. We did receive a positive ruling for a motion for preliminary injunction. So that asks the courts to reinstate our funding until the lawsuit goes through. So finally, it took about 3 weeks. We were finally able to get into our USDA portal, request the funding. We now have that, but we're concerned because chances are we will have to pay back that money. I don't know. The way the courts are ruling right now, especially at the Supreme Court level, I don't know that we're going to end up winning this. And you might ask, like, why are we doing it in the first place? We're doing it because we're so unique in this region and food system-wise. We know what the pandemic did to our community and how it really put so many people in harm's way, including farmers, because farmers were in this position where they had been pushed, our dairy farmers, to, like, if you're going to survive, you need to produce for an institutional setting. You need to produce for a school district. So all of their packaging was that. The pandemic hit, schools shut down, and they're having to throw away milk because it's not packaged, right? So we really need to be mindful of the fact that we need all kinds of farm operations to be self-sustaining and feed ourselves in this region. We need to protect our farmland. We need to make sure our farmers are paid fairly, but we also need farmers. So we do that uniquely here, and that's really important.
Part of what you're doing out here, of course, is, like you're saying, and this is, I think, what the grant, the core of the grant is, in essence, teaching people how to become farmers or be part of agriculture. Has anybody stepped out and gone out to try to do it on their own yet, or is that just a little too early to have that?
We have a farmer right now who is doing that in an urban setting. So he's on the east side of Buffalo. He's still waiting to get like the lease signed. So he's signing a 99-year lease with a land trust to farm that land. And the land trust, they're working out all the agreements right now, but he's there right now. And he's also here because we offer that wraparound support. So it's really exciting for him. Hamadi early on saw that Condola was like really good at identifying his customers and serving them.
Okay.
And he very quickly just needed more land, more opportunity. So now he has that. Do you want to talk a little bit about how he's like he lives close to that land and what that's meant?
Condola, so he lives close to the land, and like almost every farmer here has another job. So transportation is a challenge. And if you own your own car, you have to at least drive 45 to 30 minutes here. And having that farm close to his home, that is a plus. And as Kristen alluded to, Condola has early on identified his market. He doesn't even sell to PFC. He grows specialty crops, and he knows exactly where to take them. And the farm in the city right on is like, my customers will come here, grab their stuff, and get to take the produce to whatever they feel like taking it.
So how big is that lot in the city that he's going to do the urban farming at?
I think the farm itself is about an acre, but he only farms in a quarter acre now.
Right, yes. Now, yeah.
Okay.
And he hopes to build it out. So we last year were able to start helping our farmers apply for grants. And so they've been getting grants for like small tractors, walk behind equipment. And that's been really good. And then Condola's been working with the land trust to also identify like some other needs that he has. Our team went and helped him set up irrigation this year over there. So it really is like this partnership across many organizations that come together to support our farmers. It's been pretty fantastic. And then we have So this is another thing we've been working on, is we've had a lot of challenges accessing public water, for example, here. And some of that is based on the fact that the definition of a farm operation legally is quite archaic. It's basically a family, a homestead. They're growing food or producing something agriculturally. And because we are many farms, 31 small farms on 37 acres, under this nonprofit collective model, we weren't considered a farm operation. So as a result, the mechanisms that are in place to protect farmers couldn't be used. Mm. We couldn't call Ag and Markets to say, please help defend us. And we are really lucky because at all of those meetings, we're members of the Farm Bureau. They showed up at those meetings and spoke out in favor of us. We've been working with the Farm Bureau the past couple of years on that idea of how do we change that definition of a farm operation. There are a lot of other different kinds of farms across the state, but we were the ones who, you know, have been asked to do this work, and we're doing it in partnership with the Farm Bureau and support of Ag and Markets to get this changed.
Started to hear you say that the Farm Bureau is supporting you. Are you also, or inside that, getting support from so-called, if there are really legacy farmers, there aren't a lot of them around anymore, I guess, but are you finding people who are farming are supportive of what you're doing out here?
Yeah. So Farm Bureau are those legacy members?
I figured as much, but I wanted to make sure I understood
that. They are, yeah. And they're the ones who have for generations been stewarding our farmland across the state. And they're the ones who actually work really hard to protect farmers, to protect our food system. Often they're asked to do things that I think we don't understand fully. You know, it's all farmers that struggle for viability. It's the model that it seems the USDA is promoting right now is more industrial agriculture, corporate farming, and that is worrisome in that it takes a lot out of the land. It's a different kind of farming, and it's not necessarily to feed people healthy foods. It's not mixed vegetables, right? And so I think the fact that you have these legacy farmers who understand the importance that people need a diverse selection of agricultural products, and a region needs and should have the opportunity to identify how they're self-sufficient in feeding one another. I think that they're all very much in favor of that. And I really appreciate that with their leadership and their support of this farm.
Kristen Heltman-Wise, Executive Director of Providence Farm Collective, as part of our recent tour of their Orchard Park facilities. And we'll be hearing more of those conversations on a future episode of What's Next.
And to close today's show, we spoke with Duncan Kirkwood, Director of the Center for Resiliency. This October, he will host the Student Leadership Conference at Villa Maria College.
Now, obviously, the core of your work really is trying to reach those kids who need that. They need that change, that alteration and direction and goal. But at the same time, you're getting into something here, a student leadership conference. So this is a little bit different in a lot of ways, because when you think of student leaders, you're thinking of those kids who are going to be the next lawyers and doctors and, politicians and things along those lines. So tell me about this student leadership conference.
Yeah, so what happened was, as I'm traveling, I do a lot of speeches at different places, and a lot of them have been student leadership conferences. And I would go and it's like all these student leaders. In some cases, the students even plan the conference. Like I'll get on the Zoom call to like talk about what I talk about, like talk about my topics. And it's a 15-year-old in their bedroom interviewing me because they're picking the speaker for the conference, you know? And I realized we don't have a lot of those here in Buffalo. So I said, instead of complaining, let's do one. So I partnered with Erie One BOCES and we are doing a massive student leadership conference October 20th and 21st at Villa Maria College. From 9 a.m. to 1:45 p.m. And we got Rich Products is sponsoring. Highmark is one of the sponsors. Say Yes is sponsoring. And we were really excited that Senator Sean Ryan sponsored 205 Buffalo Public School students. Hmm. So that'll be our student leaders from our Student Leader Inner High Council, which is like a group of leaders from every high school. That'll be our Student Athletic Committee leadership, which is like a group of student athletes that have like a leadership committee to advocate for our students. And then students that are in my Unleash Your Greatness program that are in Buffalo schools. So that we got 40 students from Tonawanda, a group of students from Canisius High School, a group of students from St. Joe's High School, a group of students from Alden High School, of course. And I'm forgetting like one or two. Oh, Mona's House. Kelly nice. Diane, yeah. Her group of student leaders, they're going to be sending 10 students. A group of students from Duville's TRIO program, Upward Bound program. So this is going to be like the first major student leadership conference that has public school students, charter school students, private school students. We got like Maritime Charter School, Tapestry Charter School sending students. And they're all going to be in one place. We're going to bring in national speakers, national DJ, giveaways, lots of energy, but really pouring into these student leaders because yes, we got to catch up the students that are behind. We got to support the students that are struggling. But we do have some students that's doing the right thing all around Western New York. And we've got to make sure we're pushing those students to reach their potential too. So this conference is all about self-identified student leaders or student council leaders or whatever the school decides, you know, leaders. We're going to teach them time management, how to advocate for themselves, how to create change, how to use their voice, like what it means to be a servant leader, how to use leadership to make a difference at their job, like just all type of things to help push them on their journey to success as well.
And now let's also, you know, while I've been fascinated by all these different elements here, you know, the core of things, the city of Buffalo School District, it's the biggest school district, it's the poorest school district. It's the one that has unique struggles that although there are, of course, kids who are dealing with all sorts of things in all districts, but there's a lot of that in the Buffalo School Districts. So you are in there with what are, I guess you've set up what are called cohorts.
Cohorts, yeah.
Cohorts. Tell us what you're doing.
So last year, Buffalo Schools, Dr. Reynolds asked me to take my summer student leadership program and do it in a couple of Buffalo schools and stretch it across the year. So we would work with one cohort in each of two schools with the same group of 35 kids 15 times over, like basically bi-monthly, twice a month over the course of the school year. And we saw great results. We saw their attendance go up. We saw their behaviors go down. We saw their grades go, their GPAs increase. They joined student clubs and student leadership. So it was great. And so we packaged it and then I marketed it to other school districts. So we booked, we signed a contract with Frontier School District to bring the year-long program there. We signed a contract with Lockport Schools to bring the program there this year. And we signed a contract with Chattagay Schools to bring the program there. Chattagay is up in Northern New York in Essex County. And we also got a school district, what's it called? Brook Point High School in Baltimore, Virginia. I don't know, somewhere in the near DC.
Sure.
They're bringing this school, the year-long program there as well. So me and my staff will be flying back and forth to do that as well. And this is kind of where I want to head to because you can have more impact with students if I can have multiple touch points. And so, yeah, so that's my Unleash Your Greatness initiative that we're doing in the schools. And it's like an intervention type of program. And so we're very excited the direction is headed. I'm working with Cassina Frazier at Duville. She's been an amazing co-trainer. And so we're growing.
I'm also wondering about this because you're in schools a lot more than most of our listeners. I know we do have some teachers maybe listen to this in the recording and such, but most aren't in the schools. And I'm wondering about this, you know, I hear the national conversation every day on NPR, right? The national rhetoric that comes down the pike. Some might call it depressing, dispiriting. Does that impact kids? Does that impact kids? Are you seeing that?
The national conversation, no, not at all.
All right.
What I will say is every school is very different. And what you may see in a urban school like a Buffalo or like a Cleveland or Toledo or something is very different than what you would see in a rural school like in Scio, New York, or Friendship, New York. Like it is just incredibly, it's different worlds. You know, I was in one school and like it's lunchtime, the kids are like outside sitting around, they're in the front of the school. And I said to the principal, you just let the kids just wander around the building? He said, if you treat them like responsible young adults, they will act like responsible young adults. If you treat them like criminals, they will act like criminals. And so that was his philosophy. I've been in other schools where I had to walk through three metal detectors to get in the building, and a SWAT team police officers at the door checking my bag and with, you know, winding me down. So, you know, every school is very different. And I would say a lot of the national conversation centers around urban schools in poor communities. But there are rural schools in poor communities. There are suburban schools. There's a lot of places. Like, you know what I'm sorry, I don't want to take that up.
No, that's fine.
One thing, the biggest thing I've learned about this country from being a speaker,
yeah,
America is not what I grew up thinking it was. I thought America was like this country full of these big cities and we just titans of industry and all of this hustle and bustle and stuff, because I grew up in Buffalo, which is a city, large urban city, right? So my frame of reference was that's what the country looks like. Okay, that is not the truth. America is a farm. The whole country is a farm. So when you fly in America, you go from city to city, state to state, it's all farmland. There are just a few cities sprinkled in there. You know what I mean? So like all this national debate about all social issues are really around like urban areas, LA and Atlanta and, you know, Miami. No, this country is the farm. So like even in New York State, it's a farm. New York State is the country. So like, yeah, there's Buffalo. There's the big five: Buffalo, Syracuse, New York City, Rochester, Albany. After that, ain't no more cities. This is a huge state and it's only five cities. The rest is all towns, villages, farmland, countryside. And it's beautiful. So it gave me a different perspective of what our country really is. And who, when they say middle America, that really is the whole country. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I get what you're saying.
So when you hear these national discussions about really anything, these are like the hustle bustle city, Hollywood discussion, Atlanta metropolitan area type of Texas, you know, Austin, Dallas type energy. But the majority of the country are normal people just want their kids to do good in school. Kids just trying to be better than their parents, maybe do something, maybe be a military person or go to trade school, go to college. Like the majority of our country are just people trying to better themselves. And the discussions make you think it's something different because they highlight all the cities and they highlight these big debates. But in normal parts of this country, the majority of this country, it's not quite, you know, what's put on the media.
And then let me follow up with this question then, because obviously you think about this and a lot of other things. What could be or should be inside, call it the national conversation or national policy or national attitude, maybe that's the better way of saying it, that would better help that and, more importantly, help our kids?
I think that, number one, we need exposure. Kids need to see what's possible and they need to understand that their individual skill is a career. That is something kids don't know.
Okay.
So like, for example, my skill is talking. I've always been good at talking. When I was at Performing Arts, I would get in trouble for talking all the time and teachers would write on the report card, Duncan talks too much, right? But talking is now my job. If somebody had told me at 15, Duncan, you talk all the time, you could make X amount of dollars, six figures, you could be wealthy talking, I would have said, how do I do that? They'd have said, okay, join the debate team. I'd have joined the debate team. Join the mock trial team. I'd have joined the mock trial, right? But nobody told me that. I didn't know until I was 20 something that you could speak as a living. Same thing with writing, drawing, acting. Every kid has a gift, has something they love doing. So the first thing is identify what does that kid love to do and show them a career that they can do that thing they love and be successful. Whether it's gaming, whether it's you could play rock, paper, scissors now as a career. You know, like literally anything that you can imagine can be a career.
People are playing pickleball.
If you're willing,
cornhole.
If you're willing to work. So that's number one, is helping them understand that they have a gift and that gift can be a job, connecting it as early as possible.
Okay.
The second thing is moving to mastery-based teaching. I think that this idea of you're this age, you have to be in this grade, you're this age, you have to be in this grade, right? School is only this many months. Moving it more towards you need to master a subject before you move to the next subject. But if you master it early, you move to the next subject early, right? That teaching style, it needs to become the norm in schools. right? Like that just needs to be it, because we're getting teachers at an eighth grade teacher can't teach a kid that is reading on a second grade level.
Right.
There's just no amount of classroom management skills and activities they could do when half the class is 4 years behind in reading. That just, and after third grade, you have to read to learn other stuff. So if we need to have 12-year-olds in the third grade or whatever, you know what I mean? Like whatever we need to do, they need to learn how to read, master it, and then go to the next thing and the next thing. I think those two things, and make it where it's not a shame fest. Where like if a kid is behind a couple grade levels, they're like, oh, he's a loser. He's the old fifth grader. Like, no, make it where it's normal. Like, okay, in math, he's on ninth grade level, but in reading, he's on a third grade level. So you take third grade reading and you take ninth grade math, whatever your age is, and make it more where it's tailored to a person. And with AI, with technology, we can do a lot of that easier now than ever before to kind of custom make lesson plans for students.
That will do it for today's program. We'll be back on Wednesday when Jay Moran speaks with Karen King, Kelly Dumas, Tiffany Pavone, and Judith Olin about the need for a coordinated community response and early education to prevent domestic violence. This has been What's Next from Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.